Hello and thanks for joining me today. Today I have Dr. Eric Monsager. He's been on here a few times. Dr. Monsager is an Adlerian depth psychotherapist based in Switzerland. And recently I've been learning more about internal family systems, which uses a lot of parts language. If you're familiar with it, you'll know that they talk about the exile part, the manager part, the firefighter part, and it talks about how you have all of these parts that are kind of, maybe in some ways it seems like they're at war with one another because they're in some ways they're fighting against one another, but you reframe it in the sense that they're only trying to help one another. You have like the firefighter part that comes in when the exile part feels overwhelmed. And so they're all in a lot of ways working toward a common goal, not a common goal, but they all have different goals, but they're all trying to help out. And if you're anything like me or perhaps the rest of humanity, there are probably there's at times where you feel like you're at odds with yourself. I know a lot of times I want to do the best thing for myself, for my family, for other people, and but that can be a lot of responsibility and it can be really hard. And then there's like this other part of me that just wants to come in and go live a life of frivolity and ease. And but a lot of times it's actually a really big struggle. And there's might be times where you even feel some distance from a part of yourself where it's like, who is that? Or what, where is that coming from? Or I thought I had worked through that. And it's just so, I reached out to Dr. Monsager because I wanted to hear more about the Illyrian perspective on this, and he's mentioned before, and I've read in some of Adler's works about how he conceptualizes the personality as unified, and I think that was a little bit foreign to me, even with I think my small understanding of Carl Jung's works, how it's kind of you're working toward becoming whole, or you're working toward individuation, and you're working toward becoming unified. Whereas Adler says that we're already unified, from my understanding. So, Dr. Monsager, thank you for joining me again today. And yeah, with that, can you kind of let us know what you have prepared, or how
Sure.
you conceptualize this?
Daniel, I really appreciate you reaching out. And we originally had conceived this just as a friendly talk. I think both of us are happy to share it with others. But I have in mind a little bit of a dialogue. And I mean, if you could share a little bit about those parts that you experience. And I don't know if there is a, I mean, where you could illustrate the firefighter or the exile or something to that degree. I'd like to hear what the experience is like for you.
Let's see. For me, there is. So, I'm trying to think of how personal to get with it, or how revealing.
Not probably. You could even, make one up if you've heard it in class or something like that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot that way.
No, yeah, you're good. I don't mind. I'm just trying to think of a good, clear example that is worth sharing. I think I here, for instance, with the internal family systems, if you have somebody who it's like every time I try to do the right thing, then there's a part of me that comes in and is really critical of me, and then I start feeling really down, and then I end up maybe cutting or watching porn or doing something that is completely against my ideal self. So I have my ideal self that I'm striving for, but and there's part of me that works toward that goal and is and likes to be seen that way, but then there's a part of me that comes in and is super critical and then ends up there's a part of me that goes
Yeah,
completely
that's
against
excellent.
what I'm striving for.
Yeah, good. Thanks for that. So the ideal self, or the ego ideal, was a concept Adler developed, actually, and Freud kind of took over. But that's another thing. And he used it differently than Adler. Adler was concerned about how is it that we make it through life and draw from our experiences into overcoming the existential issues of not being very fit for this world, you know, without our families and the like. But this idea of trying to be our ideal self, as you said, and then finding myself doing something else, is the issue you raised earlier in our conversations on the email about Paul in Scripture. I don't do the things I want to do, and I end up doing things I don't want to do. I think he was being very humane and human in such an example. Adler would look at such a thing to say, and he often did, quoting Martin Luther, "Don't look at the tongue in my mouth. Look at the tongue in your shoes to see where you're going." Say that one. Or he'd say, "Don't look at the head. Look at the fists, because they're the ones that you're going to have to watch out for when you're interacting with a belligerent." Luther would say such a thing. Now, Adler's point also was, if I want to see what's happening in my client initially, I don't want to listen to the story immediately. I actually want to watch their body movements and the like, as if in a pantomime, because they will tell their story. They can't not tell their story because they're not thinking about the way they're expressing themselves physically, and the body is a part of the whole, and it will tell the story. Now, that's a lot of stuff around the issue of what is going on when I want to do one thing and I think about that, but I end up doing it and feeling bad about myself or actually harming myself. Adler's going to suggest that the action orientation is truer to what the person believes than the actual ideal. And that the ideal might be put there to impress myself and to make myself feel better, that I ought to do better, I could do better. More likely, because Adler believes in the community around us, the person may be struggling trying to be accepted in her or his community, their community, because they don't feel good about themselves for whatever the history is. So he would say it's an apparent dichotomy. We act as if there are two of us, and it is to its own purpose. Something that he quoted Breuer, who worked with Freud early on, also from Austria, who was one of the first one Adler could remember that talked about purposive behavior. Interesting, even prior to Adler. That is, what is going behind the scenes is helping the person accomplish. Just by the little scenario you gave me, it would be a guess of mine in working with such a person that they think they have to be right-minded or not involved in self-harm, and like they have to look good in the community, but they don't know how. And when they harm themselves, they lower the expectation. Okay, and they're relieved temporarily by the fact that the ideal has been obliterated and pushed out of the way. But also the emotion that is brought about by the, by the actual behavior is one that says, I can do better than that. So then they start the system all over again, you know, and I can get up to it. And so Adler told us in that regard, always watch out for guilt feelings. Following Nietzsche's lead, he said they're often immoral, these guilt feelings, that we can feel remorse, which Adler, the translation of the term remorse was an action-oriented movement away from the behavior that I'm not accepting of myself. Okay. Rather, or one can say I am guilty, which is a judgment or an evaluation of the thing that was done. But if I'm feeling guilty, it's not just in the Christian churches. I know this, you know, from my Jewish friends and my Muslim friends, that they also have this sense of retribution or repayment, I should say. Mm-hmm. Restitution, I beg your pardon. And some people, I mean, there used to be self-whippings and stuff like that. Do your penance is one. Holy days that where we make repair and the like. There is in our collective understanding of humanity that I can expiate my sins. And then what?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I go back to being a sinner, is how the human tends to express him or herself in such a way. So I know that addresses your very specific one, but I would say generally the parts idea, an Adlerian would say, because Adlerians are, I was told as a young Adlerian, theoretical purists, but eclectic technical people, you know, whatever works and whatever helps a person, we're for that. If it puts them in the direction of social interest and healing themselves so they can be helpful to other people. There's no objection to the idea by an Adlerian that I know of talking parts and the like, but we would look for the parts and see what they're doing for the person. And it was a fortunate slip that you made. They have the same goal. No, not the same goal, you said. They have different things in mind, but there is something that says, I am going somewhere. And that's what we call purposive behavior. And take the moment to say, that's also what Adler meant and Husserl meant by intentionality. To be intentional is not to be deliberate. Deliberate is the consciousness. And to be intentional is to not know, except in a vague kind of way, that when I get up, I'll eventually get to the door and open it. But I'm leaving now. Thank you. Goodbye. This is, intentionality is my purpose of movement through life. And I want to say a few things about that, because without that, some of the theoretical underpinnings of psychotherapy altogether fall apart. There's a fantastic author by the name of Ian McGilchrist that you'd do well to interview, but he's a very interested man, a psychiatrist who talks about the known science of the left brain, right brain kind of issues. And he says these kinds of things. Dichotomies exist. A holist, someone who is dealing in holism, doesn't say dichotomies aren't there. Left brain, right brain is a dichotomy. And there's every proof that, you know, the brains are asymmetrical in this sense. Of course, we wouldn't deny dichotomy. But if they don't work together toward a whole and toward a movement through life, they're not very good, much good to us. The left brain, roughly, detail and focus, and the right brain, big view, emotions, and things that are help us understand the bigger picture, you know? And he says, if we readapt the atomistic look, the parts approach, we make two primary mistakes, he suggests. Now, I wanted to share those with you. One is the direction goes, instead of toward the whole, where we would understand why it's all together and what the big meaning is, it goes backwards and down into the parts that says, what is this part doing and what is that part doing? And then he says, possibly more serious, what is the cause of this one? And once you drop into the causal level, it's a free-for-all, because there's no way to get out in front of things on the mind level. And so he says, instead, the sciences have always gone to gathering the detail and then seeing what is coming of this. The sciences haven't always done that, but the greater science moves that direction. Science does this, you know, scientific atomizing and trying to determine what each part is for. But once that's determined, you still don't have the whole. That's the whole gestalt axiom, you know, that the sum is greater. So McGilchrist just kind of puts out a warning that way and says, we are always looking for the greater picture. And we have a brain that has evolved to do that. It's never capitulated to the left brain, and it's never interfered with the left brain, doing its thing, protecting us, watching out for things. Okay. Now, from that point, I want to share another part that the existentialists, et cetera, and the humanists, humanistic theories, remind us that in order to be fully human here, we have to transcend ourselves. Now, that's a fairly common saying, but what could it mean if we have parts? Am I transcending my parts, or am I gathering my parts together and then transcending them? Okay, or maybe there's a simple answer to that. I don't mean to be argumentative, you know, but I'm saying the transcendence into something bigger and more important is the human endeavor that has pushed us through evolution, or pulled us through, better said, evolution for eons and eons. And so now when I look back at the parts, okay, that you named adroitly, the question has to be to me, what would be going on there? Maybe, I mean, I don't want to answer it, but I would like to ask you to come back in and say, if there was a firefighter that came in, is there a scenario you'd say that this is what the firefighter is up to, or the exile, or the comforter?
Yeah, in that way of thinking, the exile is like the wounded part of yourself that gets maybe emotionally overwhelmed or is under a lot of pain. The firefighter doesn't really think about the circumstances. It just sees a burning building and it just tries to put out the fire. So the firefighter could be the part of you that cuts or that goes to something that we might see as destructive. But the firefighter is trying to distract from the pain because it doesn't think that the exile can handle it. So it's just like called in to basically cause a distraction maybe. And then there's the manager part, which is the part of you that is going to be critical, tries to keep you in line, tries to get you back on the right path, so to speak. And then there's one other part, but I can't think of the other one. So they all have maybe different goals.
Or different objectives, one would say, when we're making, you know, managerial plans. We have so many objectives, but it all goes into the same goal. It could be. I would suggest that. That would be a good way to organize it. But I suspected this, and I just acknowledge without embarrassment, I'm not up to speed with the parts model.
You're good.
Although the family constellation thing has grabbed my attention for obvious reasons, Trinidad Lyrian. But you see, this is going to be a hard truth, or small truth. Adler says, my healing is my responsibility. And my community recognizes that and endorses me and supports me, speaking of parts, to say, we can get through this together, but it's your job. Ideally, okay? And in that regard, Adler was not merciless. He was quite a gentle soul, to hear it from any of the stories that we still have around about him. But he was unwavering when it came to using his humor and his empathy and his evidently sweet grandmotherly attitude to say, what are you going to do about this? What shall we do together? How can I help you? But in the end, it ends up your job. And I think that is being lost generationally currently. Probably won't be lost altogether, but it's not attended to at all. The firefighter sees a fire and doesn't understand why I'm burning with this thing, and just tries to save me. Thank you very much. I'll set the fire again as soon as you're gone, because I guess I needed that fire, you know? Or the exile is wandering around, not understanding where they belong and the like, and you say, come here, I've found you, I'll put you to work here and we'll work this out together, that would be helpful. It even sounds community oriented. But if I haven't addressed why the exile either exiled themselves or somehow found themselves, you know, unconnected, there would be the tendency to go back to that, unless there's not just a cognitive understanding, but a new conviction. I can still see it. Okay. Yeah. And in what I'm trying to put across here is each of those parts has a responsibility to the whole to find the way out. Which way out? There's an answer to that, because of course there's 360, or then in three dimensions, how many degrees are there that we can go? But the answer is always toward the community. I have got to heal because I can do things that nobody else can do. People might argue this, and I would accept that. I would argue politely with them, but because I can't tell somebody to help me. But I can say, I would like your help. I could use your help. I can see that you understand things. And here we are in a great example of it. You explained to me, at least briefly enough for me to interact with you, about parts models, you know, and the like. Uh-huh. So all of us together can do far more toward the healing of the world than any one person can do by getting too lost in the parts issue. I would say, though, truly, no argument with the parts as long as they heal enough so I can turn outward, not inward, or no longer inward. That's where we start. That's what depth psychology is about anyway. But we turn outward because there's much work to be done. There's much work to be done. And the many hands make light work, and it can be fun work. Ask the hunter-gatherers when they are out hunting and gathering, they're having the times of their life. Occasional danger, of course. But, I mean, that's what we learn from the Civilized to Death and some of the literature out there, is that the democratic, familial approach to life is to say, we can do this together. And it's always the motto of Adler to look that way. Is that... raise a question or two.
I think a few things that stand out is, it seems like, so with Asso, I recently, her name's losing me right now, but the very last video I uploaded, I spoke with the lady who started a Jungian Center for Spiritual Sciences, and she talked about the ultimate goal is also to turn outward, from a Jungian perspective, is also to turn outward. And that what benefits me benefits you, what benefits you benefits me, and to be. And so it's, and that's kind of across, I think, most religions as well. And it seems across therapies. So I think that is worth pausing to note. Yeah. Because I think that is also something that tends to get
this
lost.
This is something.
And yeah.
Adler mentioned this in the book you and I talked about earlier. He said, in a sense, psychology is the latecomer, and its worth is that it has, in a what he calls scientific way, but in an empirical way, we would say today, shown that the golden rule, which also appears in all book religions and in many of the spoken religions, that this is the way forward to do to other people the way you want to be treated, you know? Science has found that also a little later. And I think she's saying it from a Jungian perspective. And I say cheers from the Adlerian.
Okay. So with the gestalt picture, you have a bunch of different parts. But together, all of those parts create a unified whole. But I'm trying to think if there's an example of, because I can see what it means to say that, although it feels like there are different parts of us, there is a unified whole, and in that sense, there's a unified personality. I guess if you have like almost like a mandala, and the mandala is one whole thing, but there's a bunch of different parts. There's like triangles, maybe squares and stars, and you could say that the different shapes are fighting against one, like they're butting up against one another, because, you know, if the circles were like, you need to be a circle, why are you, why are you all pointy as a triangle? Maybe that's kind of what we're doing in terms of personality, is we have all of these different components, parts, and it seems like they're at odds with one another, because you've got a triangle over here, a square over here, and maybe a star here, but ultimately they make up a mandala, something like that. Is that accurate?
I think, look, oh, this is such a good point. You've made a metaphor. You've made a beautiful metaphor. Metaphors are meant for us to be able to communicate across the gap in such a way that my awareness of triangles and circles and colors, as you just described it, joins yours. They're separate from one another, but that's what a metaphor does. It brings also the emotional content. And Adler simply said, use them, but be careful, because the metaphor isn't everything. And people can jump into a given metaphor, like the tripartite mind, ego, id, and superego, etc. Or, you know, anyone. Maybe Jung would start, said, they're all well and good, just like I affirm the family systems is good, but it's a metaphor, and we mustn't mistake it for reality. That's always a problem. Adler, always, everything can always be different. He insisted on it. We're only taking it from our viewpoint and the best we can and explain it. So in that sense, it's marvelous. I can use a metaphor, and as far as we can go, we should go together. Then if there's still some distance to go, we need to help each other in our own other directions, complete that, you know? But I want to ask you, because of the metaphor, would you agree, or would it make sense to you that the mandala itself, mandala, has a unifying principle to it?
Like a teleological one?
Well, not yet.
Okay.
We'll get there. First step is, what organizes the mandala? I mean, in the loosest sense.
It's usually like, it's made up of a bunch of different parts, but it's symmetrical, and it's usually got some type of a boundary that, even if the boundary is, usually like, or if even if it's not symmetrical, it can be composed of like opposites. Sure. So like the left side is one theme, the right side is a different theme. A unifying principle. That's a good question.
Well, I would add, let me take a guess, because they're not all. That is the boundary. Yeah. What is equal distance from the boundary? Yes.
The center.
That's what I would say, is what it's all organized around. And I just use that as a metaphor to share this little bit that comes from Adler's very creative mind. But I mean, he was a doctor, and he wasn't just thinking this stuff up. But he certainly didn't have available to him then what we have available to us now, which Dan Siegel is very clear on. The organization of the mind starts haphazardly almost. And chaos theory is the best explanatory theory we have nowadays for showing how the mind finally doesn't coagulate. I'm mixing metaphors there. But it finally, in a little, maybe has enough connections that it starts looking for other connections. Adler called that the apperceptive schema. And we know what schema is. But he says once the schema is set, we start taking in things only through the schema. You see, it's organized itself. And I won't even see other things, just the things that come through the schema. Now, Adler's point when he talks about the when he talks about it developmentally, he says this happens probably as early as your third year. Okay. Now, that's pretty close to within 18 months. You say 18 to 3 years, 18 months to 3 years, when the hippocampus, which governs memory or helps us with memory, finally ripens enough to do its thing, where the amygdala is firing with us as soon as we show up on the scene. But it takes a hippocampus to organize. And as soon as we organize, we can start having memories. And Adler was saying, it's around this time that we have a thought about how I fit in here as a big brother, as a new baby, as a little girl, as a, you know, whatever the individual is facing at that time, they figure it out rudimentarily at 3 years or so. Now that it's that then that they're figuring out how I fit in, and that's where our goal comes from. That's what I want to say. And that goal is like the center of the mandala, and it's the fixing of the first neuronets that didn't start looking to produce other neuronets kind of like them. And it's, I'm not saying it proves it. I'm just saying it fits in the theory that is not argumentative or dismissive of today's sciences, you know? And we keep...
Would that be like, let's say, just as an example, what brings to my mind is if you have that child and that's their center and they grow up within this family and they start, everything builds off of, maybe I'm the middle child or something, or I'm the oldest, and then what goes along with being the oldest? Maybe responsibility, or I have to, set a good example, there's different things. And then the way that they learn to manage stress or emotional pain in the family, maybe they learn that, you know, that my parents are having this emotional difficulty, so I got to be the one that steps up and takes care of my siblings. So then they also put that on themselves. And when they have emotional pain, they just try to repress it or stuff it down because that's the way they've managed it. They've had to push it down in order to. Does that make sense?
Yes. They would come to learn that I don't pay attention to myself. I pay attention to other people. And it's a good start rudimentarily for humanisms and the like. But of course, kids are prone to the mistake of overdoing it and overcompensating for this. And so you're suggesting this kid may well not pay attention to the self and the anxiety that is being endorsed by parents who aren't helping this child even do it himself. He just mans up or womans up and takes care of things for people. And that organizes their understanding of themselves. Certainly it does. And I'll go this far as to say, such a person is then at risk, if you want to say it that way, for finding a partner that they can organize that is sad like mom or dad. And when I see that, I will know I'm in love. And now I know how to interact with this person. It's not quite that bold, but there you have it, is how your... secret goal or the fictional goal that you have suggested is I will be the helper in the family or the consoler in the family now becomes the adult consoler and maybe becomes a good pastor or a good doctor, maybe. But if it's a troubled and disturbed thing that's being overemphasized, they're going to get into a lot of bad relationships where they can console people. Maybe, you know? And wouldn't be satisfied until they have somebody who is unconsolable that they can press themselves to feel right about themselves.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say earlier you said that the ideal self is less real than what you're actually doing in the moment. Thinking of like, I have a few things around that. So that's, maybe this is my limited understanding of humanism, but I would say generally speaking, it's like the real put like the potential, this is hard to explain, but like the real you is probably is like saddled down with pain and grief and turmoil. And all you got to do is unload, like work through that, remove the barriers to growth, and then the individual will grow. So in some ways, that to me, I think of like the ideal self, all that you can be, that's the you that's just being hindered currently by this pain or this stuff that you haven't worked through. And if we can help you work through that pain or remove those barriers to growth, then you will become all that you are. So that's
a nice premise for therapy.
What are you?
Isn't it? I would agree. Except I think as an Adlerian, my colleagues would agree with this. There isn't actually an ideal self. That is a fiction we create for ourselves. Fictions aren't false, but neither are they true or real. They're meant to guide us through life, and we realize some of them, you know. But the fiction of an ideal is to say, if I can unload these burdens that have come to me, some through my own actions, most of them not, because the world is the way it is to say, at every moment I drop one of the bonds, I can progress in a direction that I don't know exactly what it is, except I'm getting better at that. And I get better and better and better. And I guess there's no outside limit to that. That's why Adler and Maslow liked each other so much, I think. But they were like-minded spirits who were thinking about this. And Maslow could see what self-actualization, it has its own growth pains today. But it was something like that. So our ideal self keeps us going. Remember, Adler said, we never reach the perfect community of social interest. But it always draws us toward it, which you just described. Yeah.
Is the teleological pull, is that, so we have perhaps a biological teleology. Is the ideal self or the fictional?
Ideal self is a fine word as long as we don't reify it. That's all.
Okay. What is the, is the teleology that Adler speaks about, is that purely psychological? Is that based on our fantasies or our ideal selves? Is that what pulls us, or is there something else that gives us a direction?
It's an important question. The existentialists say the future is what actually draws us. Because maybe other animals can also do it, but humans dwell in what's going to happen next. What about tomorrow? What about next year? What about the next crop? You know, what about the rainy season coming? We're always thinking about that way. That seems to be part of the organizing element and why we are meaningfully looking toward the future for the ultimate, which includes the ideal, but the ultimate, but the big you is where the concept of God and Allah and Nirvana all share common ground, you know? Yeah, I think that is part of it.
So I guess
that's where the teleologies join, you know? There's the big one, which is kind of religious or spiritual, certainly. But there is the normal one. I'm going to get up tomorrow morning. What am I going to do tomorrow morning? You know? That's teleology.
I guess, in a sense, isn't that just as real as the present?
I would ask, why would you say that? And what is the import of that? So I wouldn't deny what you might be meaning.
Yeah, because earlier when I was talking about you have your ideal self and all of this that you're striving for, you said that that ideal self is less real than what you're actually doing in the present. So in my mind, I'm trying to get to, aren't they both in some ways just as real, or are we going based on purely like a behaviorist approach?
Gosh. So enter again, McGilchrist, you know, his latest work, The Matter with Things. is trying to help us understand that we are creating this all around us. And I think he would say to you, it's exactly the same, but with limitations in this sense, that as we approach our ideal, it shifts with our knowledge, our new experience, the new people in our life. So whatever we had as an ideal yesterday with that was minus the knowledge I have today couldn't be the same ideal that I'm bringing today. And but I can grow toward it in a very real way. And then speaking of Maslow and dear Carl, Carl Rogers, you have the congruence issue, you know, that the person who is actualizing gets a clearer vision of the good, the beautiful, and actualizes that moment by moment sometimes. And so it does become real, and it's not any longer I do what I don't want to do and cannot accomplish what I want. You know, I'm thinking and loving exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. Or giving it my best effort, and that's really enough for me. That's what makes it a congruent ideal. Something like that.
Yeah. Another sidebar, and then I want to get back to the main question is the teleology then. Does the teleological pull, is there like an objective constant, or does that also shift throughout time? Or both?
Well, it depends on how you look at where it's pointing. So Adler said, and you know, that's where I'm coming from. The scientist should stay out of the decision about God. We can neither deny nor confirm. It's not our job. The psychological scientist is to aid the person in their journey, but not determine the end goal of that journey. So for a long time, as we know, psychology fought, and still it's really popular for some of these scientists, and I respect a lot of them, but they just argue against Christianity and religion all the time, you know, picking the worst examples, and it's not hard to get them. Okay, fair enough. They give no credit to the organization of religion over time and humanizing of people, and okay. But science isn't meant to destroy or to avoid, or not avoid, but deny or prove. It is there to help in our understanding. So you asked the good question, but it's to the wrong person, in a sense.
Well, that's a little bit revealing, because I'm curious. And what I had in my mind was, there's that view that the teleology is beyond ourselves. And there's also, I was wondering maybe from a psychological view, is teleology based on psychology, or like, for instance, Adler points us toward communal living, social striving. Is that like an objective teleological pull for everyone all the time? Is we're all pulled toward that, but maybe there's the path toward that. You have smaller teleological pulls that shift. Does that make sense?
I'm getting the spirit of it. Yeah, Dan. except I you might be making it more real in your mind as a pull, even than I would work with in the client arena. We only know there is tomorrow, and it feels like I want to be there tomorrow, so I'm going to act as if I'm going to wake up tomorrow and get on with my work. And it's just day by day, minute by minute, et cetera, that kind of thing. But the teleos teleological viewpoint certainly predates Aristotle and those people. And Thomas Aquinas, the theologian, picked it up and kind of adapted it to the Christian model, which, liked or not, it's a theme that shows up as heaven and hell and, you know, purgatory for the Catholics and things like that. But those are all metaphors, according to the psychological look, not judging it as only a metaphor if one believes in its actuality. But there's no proof for it on this side of the issue. And, you know, people would argue it's in the written word, therefore that's the proof. Well, that's a different kind of proof, and it's for, you know, different people. But, it's been around a long time, and it was poo-pooed for a long time. But as science has become more physics and the like and more expansive, physics itself starts to not prove, but at least approve of this kind of thinking and, you know, what's next and the like. What's next is teleological.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Is it too simplistic to say that? So the way I was thinking about it earlier is you have this ideal version of yourself that you're working toward. And a lot of times you follow through with that ideal. You make a donation, you help someone, but then you go home and you do something against your ideal. And I was looking at that as kind of like two different parts of yourself wanting different things. And basically what I got from what you were saying is that we are complex. We are more complicated than that. And kind of what we are doing right now is so let me backtrack. You were talking about when someone comes into your office, it's not so much about what they're saying, but about actions. Their body language and their actions. So I guess I could see someone in my office and their actions, say, maybe I interpret their actions as someone who is, a very helpful, genuine person, is trying to be honest and transparent, but then they leave my office and then they go push someone off the sidewalk, right? So our actions vary from time to time. Yeah, I'm still struggling to make sense of...
No, that's really fair, Daniel. I think I've got the gist of this. You're right, in my limited office, I will only see so much. That's why we do the lifestyle questionnaire to understand their early memories and their interactions with their family, et cetera. So we try to see as much as we can see in that regard. If he tells me, I left your office last week and the frigging sidewalk was so busy and no one was moving, I had to push somebody off the sidewalk to get home again. I'd be curious about that. And I'd ask that person to compare that with the kindness I had interpreted when he saw that bug in my office and he didn't stomp on it. Can you tell me about that? I want to hear them put that together first, because we all have stories. Our left brain will always exonerate us. It'll tell us, this is what... This is the reason I did that, okay? And then in our work together, if that person is trying to grow, by that I mean incongruency and toward an ideal self that they may have imagined or may not, and I would want to stimulate their thinking along the idea of a better and better and better self, we then have some baseline to start with to see how many people he pushed off the sidewalk next week. And next week, making light a little bit. But the incongruence is not a puzzle to me. It is the norm, in a sense. And if you allow me just a minute, I'll tell you what the depth Adlerians, anyway, make of that. Adler said, always look for movement. That's the idea of action, you know. But there's psychological movement and physical movement, emotional movement. All of this is movement. And it tends in a given, predictable direction. And if a person is moving one way, well, I may have just concluded this, but I had more to say, but it skipped me right now, is that we want to see if they are being consistent or not. And we will always reference them in that regard, not just what we're seeing, you know, what their emotional tone is and the like, to see if it's there is a congruence that is starting to develop. And if they feel they are, by the way, the ideal, the self-ideal we've been talking about, the ego ideal or whatever, we would say is not very clear to people. The one they can tell you about is not the one they're going for. That's where I was going, is the counterfiction. There is a need for a person or to look social, even if they're not being social, except for the really sociopathic mentality and the like. They want to look good. It's a plague nowadays to look good in front of people because of screens and stuff like that. But they want to look good. And so he may well, just in the office, the man we were talking about, the person we were talking about, want to put on the show for me so he can go tell his friends, yeah, my therapist thinks I'm pretty well put together. So that becomes the counterfiction, that kind of behavior. It's not at all social interest, as you and I have talked about before, which is the motivator to help, to accept help as needed, and to do both of those things for the betterment of something beyond. Whether I can formulate it just then or not, I'm leaning in that direction. So we have to be aware of that counterfiction. And we look for it all the time, because the structure of movement has to do with your inferior feeling, your fictional goal, where you're compensating and going for. The counterfiction that covers the goal, because it's not very social, usually, at least in the clinical population, and then your measure of social interest. And that is, metaphorically, the direction of the movement. Is it toward and helpful to people, or is it away or against or somehow hurting people, your movement? And so this just occurs to me, the counterfiction is the part. It could be a part. It could be a bothersome part.
Okay.
You know? People usually don't disown it. They just say, that's not my better self, or I was just being a rear end, you know. Well, that kind of dismissiveness goes nowhere to move into a congruent zone where the person would actually be more happy with themselves.
Yeah. I guess that you said, maybe I'm just very ignorant, but I'm trying to follow along. And I you said that incongruency does not give it any trouble in your conceptualization. And I'm thinking like, congruency to me is almost more important than if you are, like, congruency to me is one of the most important things. I don't know how to explain it, but so if you are incongruent, how can you be unified but incongruent?
Well, it's a million-dollar question. You said it earlier yourself. It's not incongruent. It's just an apparent incongruence. If you get deep enough, you see what is really going on and where they're really going. And if they say, I want to be this, but there's no action in that direction, that's a deception that they're putting out, because they want you to think I'm that, but I don't want to make the effort. I didn't want to mean to convey that, oh, we're all incongruent and, you know, what's the heck? My point is, we are all not there yet. And incongruencies likely show up. That is the human error. But to not be concerned about that and be running the government on one level and going home and beating your partner on the other, that kind of stuff, you know, is a blight on humanity. So we are always working toward congruence, to be sure. But first, in the therapeutic area, nobody to date has come to me saying, presenting problem, I want to be congruent. Help me with this one. But I have to, I want to introduce it to them and gently and sporadically and see if I can catch their interest in it and get them leaning forward to tell me more about that. Because it's going to take what we call here a lot of good, hard work. But, it's, you know, that's Adler and the reference to the repentant sinner, to Jean Valjean, is that he never tired of helping people once he got it straight in his head. He spent himself in that direction, and he enjoyed it. I'm not saying everybody should be Jean Valjean, but it wouldn't hurt the world if we were going that direction, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's that person who understands, I have been helped, you know? I couldn't have done it without somebody else. And I guess since I'm still alive, why don't I pay it back? Or why don't I participate in that? I can never pay it in a way. I don't know if I have to feel beholden that way. But I feel loved, and I want to love people with this. So what's wrong with that? That's good, hard work. It's effort, not trying. It's not just trying to be a nice person. It is making the effort to correct myself, to understand my language, to root out those things when I see a person that's different from me and I feel repulsed. That's a pretty good indication that I've got some work that hasn't been addressed. Wendell Berry being the example of trying to bring white males to an understanding of part of our legacy, you know, without being afraid of it. Without being proud of it either. That's not, neither are appropriate. We've got work to do. We've got healing to be done.
Okay. That makes sense to me. I think I understand it. And I think also, as we've talked more about it, even with like the internal family systems, it makes more sense to me thinking, like you said, they all have different objectives. But the ultimate goal is for the whole system to, move toward, you might say, self-actualization or healing or growth. They just have different objectives on how to get that to happen. Can I kind of, how much time do you have? Can I veer off for a second?
As much time as you want. Yeah. I'm loving it.
All right. I have two topics. One, you were just talking about like Jean Valjean and how he got to such a, you might say like a high place, a place of internally motivating love for other people and helping oriented. There's like, I'm trying to think of how to explain this, but I've heard, I don't know exactly if I interpret this correctly, but like the tree with the branches that reach higher into heaven has roots that reach deeper into hell. I might be saying that wrong, but that concept. And like, if you have a whole personality and you have the side that's oriented toward good behavior, toward doing good things, there has to be some type of a compensation, like nobody can, and I don't know, almost like the more good that you're able to produce and send out, the more capacity you also have for evil or for wrong. I don't know if that's, I'm still trying to understand that or even work through my misunderstandings of that, but I was curious what you think about.
These lovely thoughts. If I were to assent to that, I haven't thought about such a thing in quite a while, but it would seem to me from Adler's guidance, he said, dichotomies generally are developmental issue. Kids have to dichotomize as they organize their world. And some people forget to update that, you know. And so we end up with heaven and hell. Adler said, we have to remember all opposites are still in a continuum. They're variants of one another. They're not true opposites, okay? So if I took that concept and said that taller branches represent deeper roots, I would say, but that's within a forest. You have to remember that. And both of them are variable, you know? And I would also say if it's going deep because it needs that kind of grounding to keep it upright, it's reaching for nourishment and moisture, etc. Which is to say, who's to call that evil? You see, just because it's dark and dank and sometimes swampy and full of creepy crawlies. Well, it's keeping the tree alive. But see, there's a relativity going on there. That's what Adler wanted to bring us to. So, sorry. I've got a phone here. Sorry.
Good.
Is that...
The relativity?
Yeah. But I would just say that to look at heaven and hell or any kind of dichotomy is to put it in... we have to put it back in a continuum or some fashion of a three-dimensional world, or it's a metaphor gone wrong. So, and you've just given the expression of, antitheticals in Adler's world were how we locate ourselves in life, you know? And we have to watch out for them. If I'm not popular, everyone hates me. If I haven't gotten an A on the test, I'm an absolute failure. That's antithetical thinking. And it's a blight, and it doesn't, it makes me self-focused instead of saying I exist in a continuum or in a three-dimensional world, you know? So.
Yeah. Okay. And then this is completely separate, but this, I've been thinking about this for a while, and you mentioned this earlier. So you were talking about restitution and how people would engage in like self-flagellation and you sin and you have to repent and then you sin and repent. And so this is purely from a psychological point of view, my question, the way I'm trying to understand this currently. If you think about the different religious perspectives, and I'm going to focus mainly on Christian perspectives because I'm most familiar with that at the moment. And maybe the typical, like you mentioned Luther earlier, he came up with it, but his whole was like the penal substitution. So God was wrathful and he needed justice, and then Christ died on the cross to fulfill that wrath and to pay our sins for us. And then as long as we accept that gift through faith, then we are saved. And I remember thinking like, why couldn't God just forgive? Why does there have to be a price that was paid or a blood sacrifice? Why couldn't God just forgive? And then, so thinking psychologically about it, I'm going to mix terms and things, but I was thinking like if God represents kind of our, like individually speaking, our superego or something, like our own morality of holding us to a higher standard. And then when are we, if you've ever worked with someone who has what you might call a harsh superego, the unrelenting high standards for yourself, and you try to tell them, oh, just forgive yourself. That doesn't work. And so then, okay, well, if the superego or the harsh superego represents God in that kind of framework, what is Jesus? Is he just like a scapegoat, like a defensive projection onto something else that pays the price for us, which then causes the superego to be a little bit less harsh for a time? And then That's why we focus on Christ as the scapegoat, and we feel better, the superego lessens, and then we come back around to realizing how sinful we are, and then so that
that's coherent,
that process repeats itself.
My reflection on that is that the substitutionary payment theory or theology is one among several Christologies. And I don't mean to dodge that. I think that's not the best one for today, because it does make God the Father into a brutal, unforgiving monster. And it's what those earlier scientists I was talking about glory in that kind of stuff, because they can't understand it. And frankly, trying today to understand it when it was actually an issue 2,000 or more years ago, when it didn't make better sense because the world is organized that way, doesn't mean we have to only embrace that Christology. The book of James and the book of Peter and the books of John all say it a little bit differently. And so there's different ways to say it, you know, because I would not subscribe to God being just a voice in my head. God is an endpoint. See, my issue would be God is the fictional final goal that might not be fictional. That's not for me to decide. He is the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
Adler said it was social interest, pure social interest, which means all of us are functioning for the best of ourselves and others. And it is the harmony of harmonies in the end that we can never reach, but we can always strive for it. And Jesus stands as that. That is the Alpha and the Omega, one of the Christologies. Okay? He is all in all. And that's not substitutionary. It's a different kind of approach to understanding Christ, you know? I think that this is where I would go with that.
I see.
I want to share these names again. David Bentley Hart is a Orthodox Christian theologian and philosopher. And he has interviewed McGilchrist, and they have a great mind meld that is worth watching, if you can remember those names. But Bentley Hart is no soft thinker, and he has an idea that is well worth modern or contemporary Christians looking at what this endpoint looks like. Because his metaphor allows for God to be God, but us not to ever get there, you know? And there is forgiveness for everyone. That's the nature of God. Everyone, at some point in the end, all the horrible people we can think of also, because God's love would heal. Anyway, that's a universalism, they call it. I'm just saying it's, you know, these are good people thinking through ways, just like Paul was trying to think through it, and Hans Kuhn, some of these guys.
Yeah, I guess thinking of like what that, so kind of the repentant sinner, like Jean Valjean, or the kind of the Christian message is that we have been accepted and we are loved as we are. And that then has such an effect on us that it promotes us toward doing the same. And for people who have a difficult time with self-acceptance, even Christians who I'm familiar with someone who almost felt like he twisted Jesus's arm into dying on the cross for his sins. And that was how self-critical and harsh with himself that he was. Someone like that who has a difficult time feeling accepted. I guess I'm trying to think through, so that the penal substitutionary theory, psychologically speaking, that seems to work for some people in how does it work? Well, maybe it works through scapegoating or projecting or something like that. But for someone who it doesn't work for, and they just don't feel any self-acceptance, how do you maybe move someone toward understanding that they are the way that they are? They're just, they're loved and they're accepted.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think
it's a great,
that.
I mean, these are so challenging. I go back to Jean Valjean and I go back to AA. Not that it's the only thing or even the best thing. It certainly is the best for some, but it accepts you as you are. And accepts people who have finally accepted themselves as they are, you know? And there is a freedom that comes with that. Ask anybody that attends. There's a freedom that comes from that. Uh-huh. And they are also spiritually based. Some people would argue religiously. But, you know, they've done great things with the higher power. And But the idea of being forgiven is only one aspect of the whole thing. And that's what Jean Valjean found out, that was an instantaneous thing in his life that he did not expect. And he didn't worry about it. He just got to work because he was inspired, literally, to give back. Uh-huh. And I think that's the message of Jesus. I mean, sorry, it doesn't matter what I think about it. But there is, within the scripture itself, Jesus... Wow, Hans Kuhn. Jesus, in a sense, deserved to die because he had broken the laws that they said he had broken. And to the authorities at the time, he was a malefactor, you know? He was talking to embrace prostitutes and forgive people, and he's not God, so how can he do that? And, well, there was a lot of stuff that he did that got him crucified. But that wasn't the last word. That's all I can say about it. I don't think it's so much an issue that he died for me because I deserve the same thing. I don't know about punishments today. They haven't worked they never worked then because you still got criminals around, you know, and the death penalty that they're still trying to bring in, you know, step back in human development. It doesn't work. It is not a retardant. The only thing that works is love and acceptance and teaching them. I understand incarceration might have to be helped for some people who feel they cannot turn the corner as criminal psychopaths and like, but they should not be treated like animals. Mm-hmm. They should be treated respectfully as much as possible. So I just set aside that whole thing of substitution. Punishment is not what God was about. And God was not punishing Jesus, in my opinion. The model is that we can follow a way that is socially interested. And if there was ever an example, and there have been several examples of people imbued with social interest, clearly Christ was one of them. And how could we deny Buddha that he was, you know? And aspects of Muhammad, certainly, or who am I to limit it? I don't know all the stories, but I'm not trying to equalize them. I'm only saying that there have been people on fire with the idea of the potential of the human being and with a personal relationship of some sort with their teleology. I'm going somewhere with this, and I'm happy to take people with me, you know?
Well said.
May I say something about the parts and whole thing that we started with?
Yeah, please.
Jangled this in me before. I would like to say that I'm in no way saying that any model today is better or worse or should be outed or not. My message has always been pay attention to Adler because you can enrich your field from that point of view. And I think also not all theories or techniques or programs today are for everybody, but they are for certain people. And I'm happy for the richness of the field, you know. Having said they're not for everybody, some people need to go further. And there has to be a depth psychology depth psychotherapy, I believe, to take people the distance when that is called for and chosen, you know, and elected or asked for. And where the parts model, I think it's a healing element that should be well studied, well applied. And if the person wants to go further with something, then they should certainly go further. You know, maybe not every theory, nor is every therapist for every person. So, but there's a little bit that can help everybody. That's my only constant message.
No, I like that. I think this is a good place to stop for now.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the engagement and the topics you bring up. Really,
we're
in tune that way. So.
No, thank you. I